Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Just a little heads up, this week's episode features conversation that explores eating disorders, suicide, and sexual abuse. Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
It turns out that I worked in the good old days. It didn't feel like it at the time when I was, you know, I was earning less than the parking meter and I was, you know, working 97-hour weeks and, you know, coming home from every shift covered in, you know, bodily fluids and falling asleep at the wheel. I had the awful realization that I was going to be sick, and this was the wrong house to be sick in, because it was like a museum. So but I thought, you know, I'll go to the toilet and I will put my head deep in the bowl and I will do like a CSI cleanup. What I need is a fake agent. I was spending more time scripting these messages from imaginary agents and coming up with their lives and personalities and character arcs than I was actually doing any paid writing.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a doctor turned comedian turned best-selling author. You may be one of the 3 million people in 37 languages who devoured his hilarious, harrowing and very telling memoir about his 6 years as a junior doctor called This Is Going to Hurt, in which he charted the joyful highs and the gut-wrenching lows of a young, overworked and overwhelmed NHS doctor. You could even be one of the 8 million who watched Ben Whishaw play him in the BAFTA-nominated drama of the same name last year, or you might have been lucky enough to go and see him work live as a stand-up. Growing up in a family of doctors in London, he followed the family's well-trodden path into medicine and secured a job as the junior doctor. But the realities of the role took their toll, both physically and emotionally. And as a means of processing the experiences he was facing day in, day out on the wards, he started performing stand-up comedy, reading extracts from his diaries from his time in practice at the Edinburgh Festival. Inadvertently, making people laugh was a very powerful antidote to the stresses of his day job. But it wasn't until he left medicine altogether and had established himself as a comedy writer that he found the time to write This Is Going to Hurt. Then its follow-up, Twas the Night Shift Before Christmas, and now the third volume of his diaries that's both a prequel and a sequel called Undoctored, the story of a medic who ran out of patience. He now lives in Oxford with his husband James, a television producer, and has become a very powerful voice for junior doctors, advocating for better conditions for them, as well as a greater understanding of the challenges they face. This summer, you can catch him live across August at the Edinburgh Fringe at the Pleasance in his show Undoctored, This Is Going to Hurt More. I can't wait to talk to him. Let's dial him up. It's Adam Kay. How are you, sir?
I'm all right. How are you, Kate?
I'm good. I mean, as far as my doctor's notes goes, were they on fleek, on point?
Yeah, that was lovely. Yeah. Sort of, you got me thinking right back to the wards and thinking about my former colleagues who are now doing exactly the same thing that inspired me to get This Is Gonna Hurt down on paper last time, striking for their pay and conditions, and which makes it slightly depressing that, you know, nothing has changed in, you know, 6-7 years. And in fact, I suspect things are an awful lot worse than they ever have been on the wards.
I mean, yes, because this book was written pre-pandemic, pre-Brexit. Both of those things have had a huge impact on the conditions in which we expect junior doctors to work.
It turns out that I worked in the good old days. It didn't feel like it at the time when I was, you know, I was earning less than the parking meter, and I was, you know, working 97-hour weeks and, you know, coming home from every shift covered in, you know, bodily fluids and falling asleep at the wheel. But after COVID, after the worst of COVID, because of course it's still here, and within a huge crisis in recruitment and retention of staff, it means that the people who are working on the wards these days are often doing 2-3 people's jobs at once, and which is an unsustainable place to be. You can do two people's jobs for a bit if you're covering someone who's away on holiday or covering maternity leave, whatever it is. As long as you know that on this point in the calendar, I can go back to doing one person's job. At the moment, if you work in the NHS, you're doing more than one person's job. And not only is that person never coming back to work, but every single week, more and more people are leaving because it's an unsustainable place to work. And I worry that the powers that be don't quite realise how serious this is, and more importantly, how much more serious it's going to be unless the tune changes.
Which is where I think your first book and your subsequent ongoing conversations around this have been so helpful to junior doctors, because the government spin on this was, it was all about money. And you, from the get-go, were going, it's not. This is unsustainable. Nobody goes into medicine for the money. By the time you've qualified to work in medicine, you are knee-deep in debt for the privilege of being able to go and work for less than the parking meter at the hospital you work at generates by way of income. And you've been able to humanise that narrative.
I've been very lucky through this book that it's given me quite a loud voice, because historically doctors have had quite a quiet voice. And certainly the first wave of strikes, you know, a bunch of years ago that sort of led to This Is Going to Hurt coming out, the government was saying, oh, the doctors are being greedy. And the doctors were saying, we're not being greedy. This is a patient safety issue if this doesn't get sorted out. And the government have a much louder voice than doctors. And so, but this book meant that I had a platform, and there were people who were interested in me going on their, you know, and their TV shows and their radio shows and their podcasts to say, this is what it's like. And you're very right to mention student debt. That's in fact something that is newer than my time in medicine. My debt was about £20,000, which is, you know, it's obviously a huge chunk of money, but at the same time, nothing compared to doctors qualifying today. I've been seeing on Twitter, people have been sending their student loan statements. They're qualifying with debts of over £100,000.
I mean, 3 years at uni for a bog standard degree, if such a thing, if I can call it such a thing, you're looking at 50 grand, right? That's 3 years of study. So
and five or six years for
study is,
five or six years. So it multiplies up. And it's not like America where you're walking into these huge salaries. When I qualified as a doctor, I was earning 25% more in real terms than doctors who qualify today. And I absolutely wasn't 25% better than them. I was 25% worse than them, I'm sure.
But also, let's point out, you weren't well off.
No.
You weren't flush with that cash,
There were no Ferraris involved. Michelin stars did not feature on my menu. And all the doctors are asking for, which doesn't feel like it couldn't be any more reasonable. They're asking for restoration of their salary to be just what it was. And look, it's the NHS's 75th birthday this year. The NHS isn't buildings, and it isn't bedpans, and it isn't MRI machines. It's people. 1.1, 1.2 million people who work there and falling.
It's one of the biggest employers in the UK as well, isn't it?
The biggest employer in the UK. But who knows how long it will be for, because people are leaving because they cannot justify staying, because it's taking a toll on them that's too tough, and they can't manage doing all these people's jobs, and their employer don't even give them the dignity of allowing them their pay to remain the same. It has to fall in real terms. So, and if too many people leave, then is the NHS going to have another 75 years, another 5 years even? I don't know the answer to that question. It's a crisis. It's a real crisis in recruitment and retention of staff. And either the government sees this and doesn't care, or doesn't see it and are walking off a cliff.
I think they can see.
I fear you're right.
And if the pandemic didn't teach us the true value of the NHS, then some might suggest we're being governed by clowns. talking of which, you're taking this as a subject matter back to where it all began this summer. From the 2nd to the 28th of August, you've booked a very, very big venue in Edinburgh. Well, it's a prestigious venue, the Pleasance. And you're running how many shows there across the festival?
Oh, it must, it must be something like 25, 26 shows. So by the end, I should have it right, shouldn't I?
Yeah, let's hope so. Practice makes perfect, Doctor. But how do you make this stuff funny? Especially when everybody that you talk to about this is invested, because everybody relies on the NHS. So it's a very different and unique place you find yourself as a comedian with a mic in hand, isn't it?
It's an interesting one. I use the comedy really to trick people, I think, and to find an audience who probably wouldn't go to a show that talks about, you know, the state of the health service, but do want to listen to silly, disgusting, weird, whatever stories from medical school and working on the wards and whatever. And so I bring people in, whether it's into my shows or into my books, with the promise of humour, which I hopefully deliver. But I like it, certainly, when I go to a show, if it's made me laugh, that it's also made me think a bit. And that's what I always try to do with my audiences. And so far it's worked. I've been trying the show out, and it's I think it's nice to have a blend of these different things. And it's so, as well as being sort of silly and funny, it can be a celebration of the NHS, which is, to my mind, our greatest achievement as a nation.
You're so right, in as much as you lure people in with the funnies, you know, the guy that comes in to have a remote control removed from his backside passage, or so on and so forth. But the stuff that I wake up thinking about, having spent the weekend with my nose firmly in your books, is the fact that our doctors don't get the same level of psych analysis and support on, certainly at any point in their career, actually, than a Tube Driver or a Love Island contestant?
Yeah, that was an analogy I drew, and just the idea that you're more supported on a reality TV show, which of course you should be. Everyone should have this level of support. It's, you know, it's no denigration to Love Island, which I love. But
you know, junior doctors are sleep deprived, making life and death decisions. They need that support more than anyone, you could argue.
You would absolutely argue that, and you'd be right to argue that. For some reason, the stigma surrounding mental health in doctors is probably 10 or 20 years behind the way we approach mental health in the rest of our lives, the way that almost everyone else does. And to the extent that, I mean, this is the most awful statistic, one doctor in the UK takes their life every 3 weeks. And to the extent that, you know, I don't know if it's almost every doctor, but you know, most doctors know someone or have worked with someone that has taken their life. And that should be, you know, a national headline every time it happens. It should be an outrage. It should be the NHS's top priority. How do we stop this happening? But such is the stigma around mental health that it gets brushed under the carpet. Such is the stigma around mental health that it's only in the last few years that medical schools have actually even started talking to doctors-to-be about how they will cope during the bad days. If you support someone who's had, you know, an awful traumatic day, it will cost a bit of money, you know, giving them the support. It might cost the organisation some money in giving them a week or two off. But that is the best possible investment in that person, because they're much more likely to be able to continue to do their job. If there isn't that support, they will continue. They'll work for another week, month, year. But eventually it will accumulate and they will burn out, or they'll realise they can't go on anymore. And you know, most organisations realise this, but the NHS is slow to get it.
It's shocking, really, because it is a false economy. If nothing else, it stacks up as a bad exercise in business, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does.
It makes more sense to invest, because what you recoup is of way more value to the business, and by business I mean the National Health Service, that you're trying to support. It's just, yeah.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, I know that you tried to show this in all its warts and awful glory with the BBC drama. And you really did bring so much of that to life. The chaos, the confusion, the fact that a doctor is just a human being, that we've got to stop seeing the uniform before we see the human being that fills it. What was it like watching yourself being played by an actor, by the brilliant Ben Whishaw, but also to have your husband executive producing it as well?
I mean, I was really, really proud of the TV show, of all the cast. You know, Ben and Ambika, who played Shruti, I thought was absolutely phenomenal, and a huge, great cast of giant talent, and the talent off screen, our directors Lucy and Tom, and all the producers, and the sound, and the design, and the editing, and it's been wonderful seeing so many of those departments getting nominated and awarded, you know, various gongs in the last few weeks and months. It was a real privilege having the chance to write it for telly, and I firmly centred it on that, exactly what you were talking about, the mental health, because I thought, if the hospitals aren't going to talk about it, then I can get this into what ended up being 8 million homes, and then that makes it an unavoidable talking point. And I thought Ben, in particular, I think he's the most phenomenal actor. You know, I didn't see him as playing me, because the version I wrote of my character was so different to, you know, to make the story work the way I wanted it to, I had to turn him into something a bit more extreme and turn everything up.
Cartoon him up.
I don't think Ben, yeah, but I don't think Ben can play a cartoon because he always finds the truth and the heart and the real in what he does. Mm. But some of the situations we made very extreme. We made a lot of the decisions that he made as a character really, really bad ones with quite severe consequences. So he ended up in front of the beak, about to, you know, potentially lose his job as a result of it. But yeah, it was extraordinary to see such an amazing actor at work. And what's it like having my husband being my boss? Okay. I'm saying okay because he'll probably listen to this.
Well, what I loved, because as alongside watching the drama, I was reading Undoctored. So I'm finding out kind of what happens next. James is James is punching big time in his career, right? So this is your husband. He ran BBC Studios at an incredibly young age. He's produced huge, sat as an executive producer on huge shows like Great Game of Thrones. But when you two met, you were, I mean, not in that place. You were living in a bedsit. You were both unproven in your new, you know, certainly in your new profession. And look how far you two have come together, only to end up having him execing your life story. That's quite a unique strain to put on any marriage.
It's been really, really nice, to be honest. We were starting out in our respective careers at the same time, and working in the, you know, the most junior rungs of television as a writer or a producer. It's not particularly glamorous. You're scrabbling around for work, and we've hopefully supported each other along that journey. I mean, for the vast majority of the journey, it was him supporting me financially because he was a lot more successful than I was. And now it's nice that we've both found a bit of success in our different corners of the media.
You are a literary sensation. And Game of Thrones was a game changer in television. So you're more than a little bit successful. I think that bedsit that you found yourselves living in, you've come an awful long way, metaphorically and on every other level, from those days. And you seem to have, climbed the mountainside together. Really, that's nice. That would be my observation. But obviously, I what do I know? Which one's Richard and which one's Judy in this professional marriage?
I think we're more Giles and Mary from Gogglebox.
I love it. But the marriage has survived, and the drama is available on iPlayer. For anybody that hasn't seen it, I would encourage you to do so. It's wonderful. Okay, I've tried to put together three thought-provoking questions for you, Adam. There's so much I wanted to ask you that, you know, frankly, three is not enough, but it's going to have to suffice. So are you ready to dive into the first one?
Let's do it.
Actions often speak louder than words, and that was certainly true for you on the day that your dad took you up into the loft of your childhood home and literally showed you how much he loved, cared, and was interested in you, despite struggling to ever really show it. So can you tell me more about that moment and how his curated museum of your life and those of your siblings shifted your perspective on your childhood, certainly as you revisited it to write about it in your books?
After leaving medicine, I found myself living with my parents from time to time. It's weird going back to your parents. No, it's no one's ideal situation.
Especially, I mean, you were divorcing.
It was,
you'd just left your marriage, you'd left your profession, and there you were having to kind of, you know, live in amongst their disappointment.
Yeah, we're not a family of talkers and huggers and thoughts and feelings. I was there, and it was announced that there were some various boxes he wanted me to dispose of my stuff. And I was like, all right, what's this? And so we went up into the loft, and he had basically never thrown a single thing away relating to my life or those of my three siblings. Every single piece of homework, every, program from a school concert we'd been in, absolutely everything was up there. And I went through some of the boxes. A lot of the boxes just end up in the skip because, that was just too much. Particularly stuff from medical school that I'd left at his house. And it did bring back a lot of memories, just like weird things, like the student rail card that I had when I was at medical school, and I had this terrible terrible blonde frosted tips, which I'm now using as the author photo. I think it's the author photo in the back of Undoctored, that terrible photo. And like, just for instance, that ended up becoming a chapter in Undoctored, because those were the frosted tips that I cut off in a hospital ward.
I mean, your dad taking you up into the loft that day, really, A, it gave you most of the material for the third volume of your memoirs, but also it gave you probably like the biggest hug in terms of showing you how much he cared about you, even though he struggled sometimes to evidence that. It didn't always feel tangible, did it, in terms of the way you wrote about your childhood?
People care in different ways, don't they? And everyone wants the best for their children, obviously, it goes without saying. And for my parents, the best was going into an inverted commas sensible job. And, as an immigrant Jewish family, there are an acceptable list, I think, or certainly were, of jobs that you should aspire to go into. You should be the doctor, the lawyer, the accountant, the architect, the civil servant, that, whatever it is. And somehow, light-hearted gagsmith wasn't on the list, and nor was, in fact, one thing I enjoyed most at school, which was playing music. And so I was, maybe strong-armed is too strong a word, but certainly very heartily encouraged to go into medicine. And we were talking about the retention of medical staff. In order to retain staff, medicine is a job that you have to go into with your eyes wide open. It has to be a job that you 100% fully consent. And consent means knowing the good and the bad. If you're ever having a procedure done, the form says, this is why we are doing it, and these are the risks. And I think anyone going into medicine needs to know both sides of that coin. And I'm not sure I was given both sides of that coin. I think I've now potentially helped other people considering medicine to see both sides. I've had the odd person complain that their son, daughter, grandchild, nephew, niece, whatever, wanted to be a doctor at some point, and then read my book and no longer want to be a doctor. And the answer to that is good, because if that book's going to put you off medicine, then the job itself is really going to put you off medicine.
And I don't think another passage that you included in Undoctored, which again, opened your eyes to the realities of the job, but B, also the realities of your father's existence. As part of your medical school training, you have to go and live and work for 2 weeks with a practicing GP. And it made you understand why your dad came home and had very little to say because he was just exhausted. He'd given the best of himself to his patients all day. And you really got an insight into what it was to walk in his shoes, didn't you?
I did. It was at the time, it seemed to make no sense to me why, rather than just popping to, you know, popping to a local GP in working hours and, you know, and seeing what they did, why there would be this residential aspect where you would go and live with, you know, a family or whatever the setup was. This was a guy who lived on his own that I stayed with. I have never seen anyone work harder in their life than this GP. And again, we're in good old days territory because there are now fewer GPs than there ever have been. There are more patients per GP, patients per surgeon than there ever have been. This guy would turn up early, and it's like in those films where there's a training sequence because you're becoming a cop and you're in this firing range. And then all of these like cardboard figures come flying out towards you, and you have to shoot the baddies with their swag bags, and you have to leave the pedestrians who are sort of holding their hands up, and they're coming so fast and so fast and so fast. That was what it felt like. He was having a matter of minutes to see these patients, and every single time working out, is this person fine or is this person really sick? You know, what's the right thing to do? And it's such an exhausting skill. I mean, I realised at that moment that, I mean, I enjoyed this guy's lifestyle. I, you know, I went to the house in a nice village, and I could start to see myself with a dog and, you know, wandering around the park and everyone calling me a doctor and stuff like that. I thought, oh, that's quite... But the actual job itself was so, so tough. And it's clearly what my dad experienced. He worked in a different environment. He worked in a very deprived part of London for 40 years. And I can understand why you would come home and just be like, you know, zipped up, which is also what I did. And it's probably what most doctors do. You don't talk about it when you get back home.
It's funny, isn't it? It all goes 360. It all goes back to the same thing. People need to be better supported right from the get-go. They need to have their eyes open to the realities of this incredibly demanding role. And, you know, I started this question with actions speak louder than words. The fact of going to live with that GP for a week, the act of doing that spoke louder than anything your dad could have told you about the realities of his existence as a GP.
Yeah, I think that's... I think that's absolutely, absolutely right. It was a very interesting couple of weeks for another reason. The doctor in question had a very particular attention to detail when it came to cleanliness. And I, as a guest in his house, had to go along with this. So it involved wearing special socks when I was inside, so that my horrible socks didn't get any dirt on the carpet. And it involved, you know, wiping down a door handle once you've used it. And maybe it was, you know, this doctor's way of getting some order in his life when work was so chaotic. Anyway, there was one day, and I did a good job of sort of keeping his pristine home as pristine as I could. There was one day, though, I went to the pub to sensibly do some revision, because, you know, you've always got exams around the corner at medical school. And so I sat there, and then a glass of wine, and then the landlord came over, and he asked me if I was working with with this GP. I said, yeah, I was. And he said, what a great guy the GP was, which he was. And he gave me a bottle of wine, and then the wine kept flowing. It was the least he could do. And I was like, wow. I mean, this was potentially the point where I thought I quite liked this existence, the free wine part. And then the revision, you know, took a turn at some point, and I don't really remember the quantities involved. But I went up to, I went back there and did all the special socks and upstairs, and I went into bed, and bed was spinning quite badly. I hadn't really eaten anything. The food options weren't great. It was like a sort of a co-op cheese and onion sandwich was the only vegetarian thing on offer in this village. And, and I had the awful realization that I was going to be sick, and this was the wrong house to be sick in. Because it was like a museum. So, but I thought, you know, I'll go to the toilet and I will put my head deep in the bowl and I will do like a CSI cleanup afterwards of any, anyway. So there were a couple of bursts of vomiting, but my head was so, my nose was basically touching the water. It all stayed in the bowl. And then I thought I was clear. I thought I was totally out of the woods after two. And then there was a third round, and it was the strongest yet. And I don't quite know how this happened. I imagine the overall rise in pressure in my entire body not only forced the... I'm sorry, everyone's meant to be drinking this with a glass. Listen to this with a glass of wine. This may be off-putting for the wine. As well as the vomit.
But you had drunk all the wine by this point, hadn't you?
Yeah, okay. There's no nice way of saying this. There was a jet of diarrhea at the same time, which shot across the room. And the thing it mostly destroyed was a polar bear white plush bath mat. And so I didn't really have a plan at this moment. So I wrapped I sort of bundled the bath mat up to take to my room. By this point, it had made enough noise that it had woken the doctor up, who came into the hallway and saw me naked, holding a bath mat covered in shit. And we didn't speak about that. But then again, as discussed, doctors don't like speaking about difficult matters, do they?
Oh, my God. This man had been so hospitable in bringing you into his life. And...
Yes, yeah, it doesn't reflect well on me. So I guess I'm asking for forgiveness.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This week's episode is brought to you by British Airways Holidays and Las Vegas. Yeah, Vegas, baby. British Airways Holidays offers the full package there, including flights and hotels to suit all budgets, with a 24-hour helpline, generous baggage allowance, and all bookable with a low deposit. With so much to see and do, both on and off the strip, Las Vegas is the ultimate holiday destination. Now, of course, there's a famous saying, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. That's not entirely true, though. Certainly not for the next 4 minutes, because both myself and one of my best mates have been to the world-famous Las Vegas Sadly, not together, although that was originally the intention. So let's dial her in and find out what happened for Tamsin Outhwaite when she touched down in the desert. Hello, babe.
Hello. Isn't it sad that I wasn't on that trip?
Do you know what? It really is. So let me just establish, right? We're talking about Vegas and how you can have a multitude of experiences there. So I went on a girl's trip that you were supposed to be on. It was Nicole Appleton's 40th birthday. But what about your trip to Vegas?
Oh.
Who did you go with?
It was very much the opposite of how you imagine Vegas. So I went with an ex-boyfriend of mine many, many years ago, and we hadn't known each other very long. And we got there and I slowly realised that this was not going to be the person to experience Vegas with. He soon realised exactly the same thing. And
how many days in was this?
We were only there for 3 days. So this was pretty much as soon as we got there. And I think he realised at the same time. And he then got suspiciously quite ill and needed to stay in bed for the whole time. And I thought, I'm not going to stay in the room at the Hard Rock Hotel. I am going to go out and have a Vegas experience on my own. Neither of us obviously wanted to be around the other one.
This is a disaster, but brilliant. I tell you what did surprise me about Vegas was the amount of choice that's on offer there. You know, there's museums in Vegas. There's the old town of, you know, part of Vegas where I loved exploring. I was quite carried away with the romance of it.
I think that everyone has an idea of Vegas. What I didn't realise was just how much talent and how many different things there were to see and do there. I mean, it actually made me want to go there and be in a show.
Did it?
Yeah.
We saw so many shows. We ate the best food. I mean, the food. What people don't understand on a food level is some of the best chefs in the world are working out of Vegas.
Well, yeah, I that's how I felt about the performers. Some of the best performers, some of the best singers.
Yeah. But a great way to do it now, I think if I was to go back now, I'd go and do 4 days of back-to-back entertainment in Vegas and then shoot out to one of the brilliant spas that they've got in the desert there now. And,
yes.
I mean, those desert spas are next
level. I love
that. It's total White Lotus territory.
Shall we do that?
Shall we do that?
Do the spa at the end, so you arrive.
Yeah.
And you do Vegas and then you retreat to the desert to a lovely retreat.
Yeah. That would be great. So we could land, go and see loads of shows, eat all the food, walk the streets, not really sleep because there's too much to do.
Yeah. See loads of entertainment and then...
just go and lie down like lizards.
And just lie down in the beautiful heat, being pampered.
See? People would never think that Vegas could be a health spa destination. So whether it's live entertainment on the strip, heading out to amazing restaurants to eat your body weight in fine food, beautiful sights all across Nevada, or brilliant shopping opportunities, all made better, may I say, by British Airways, Holiday's 23 kilogram baggage allowance per person, there are millions of things to do on your next trip and, well, only one place to do them. Explore Las Vegas with British Airways Holidays and experience all it has to offer for yourself. Secure your holiday with a low deposit from just £75 per person at ba.com/Las Vegas. That's ba.com/Las Vegas. Adult protected, T's and C's apply. Are you ready for your next question?
I am.
You are known for the phrase, this is going to hurt. And in Undoctored, you share some really difficult moments and chapters from your life that you've spoken about. Agonising over whether or not to include. I think there were certain chapters that came in and out of the book. And understandably, because you cover off in this third book, you cover off your experience of rape, your experience of eating disorders, divorce from your wife and your subsequent marriage to James. So which chapters of the book did you have to think long and hard about sharing? And why did ultimately you go for the pain option of including them? Because ultimately, sharing that information, the gains are for other people. It's a very painful thing for you to have to sit here and discuss having questions like this put to you. But you know that somebody else may find help in that, right?
I think you've you've answered it precisely. It's the thought that if one person gets something positive from a chapter that was hard for me to write, then it was worth me doing. And like talking about my disordered eating, which was a really big part of my medical school and since. It was so personal, and the book would have been fine without it. I mean, it's not, the book doesn't hang on it, but I can't even say that it was good for me to write. I mean, some difficult things I've written about, you know, I felt better for having written it. Chapters like that were painful to relive, you know, embarrassing, humiliating, painful. But I sort of knew in my heart that some people would read it and might do what I didn't do at the time and get some actual help. And wonderfully, I mean, not wonderfully, because it's, you know, this is people who have suffered and have been ill and are still ill. But wonderfully for me, lots of people have written to say that reading what I had to say gave them was the catalyst for them to go and seek help, make the first appointment with a GP or contact a counsellor or speak to a friend or speak to their partner about it. And I'd like to think that hopefully they found the help they needed and managed to, you know, to move forward from that on a long and difficult journey.
Also, Adam, I think, you know, and I say this as the mother of a 14-year-old boy, I don't think it's ever been harder to be a young person, male or female or however you identify, when it comes to your body image and people's ability to comment on it so readily, for the constant demands to share imagery of yourself that we didn't have growing up. I think it's really important as a conversation opener amongst men, because there is so much disordered eating around men and the expectations from have these ridiculous Love Island style bodies, which are frankly unhealthy.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And I really feel for people growing up in this image-centred environment. There's almost no pictures of me from back then, pre-Facebook, pre-Instagram, to the extent that I'm using an old travel card picture as my author photo from back then. It's interesting you say men. I would say the two biggest groups of people who've been in touch, and I mean this, you know, in their dozens and dozens, have been men who identified with some of the stuff I said and had struggled to speak to anyone before, and also healthcare professionals of all descriptions and of men and women. Because that ties into what we were talking about earlier about the stigma of mental health. You know, I write in that chapter, you know, about being at medical school and knowing that something was very, very up, and, you know, other people having found out about what exactly was going on with me, and begging me to go and get help, but still not getting help, because a part of me thought I would somehow end up struck off as a doctor for having an eating disorder. And it doesn't make any logical sense, because does it make sense that you'd be struck off as a doctor for having an illness? Because, you know, mental illness, physical illness, just an illness in a part of your body. And
it's the stigma, though, isn't it?
It's the stigma. And it was so powerful and so ran so deep, and I believed it so much that I didn't get help at that time. And still, even though we're in more enlightened times, there are doctors and nurses and midwives, radiographers, everyone who's been in touch with me saying, I'm afraid of what will happen, but all that will happen, I know, is that it will all be positive. You can only get better.
You're so right. And you're right. Not, you know, all of the difficult chapters that you included, the book would have succeeded without those. But I would say that your contribution, I mean, you'll never be able to measure it necessarily, but your contribution on those topics will help others inordinately, especially around the complexities of somebody coming out of a marriage, as you did, to a woman, to then transitioning to a marriage with a man, and all of the complexities that sit around that, the stigma that you felt around that, and wrapped in amongst all of that, a horrible sexual assault that you thought, well, did I put myself in line for that? Which of course you didn't, you know that, but I think you raised some really valid questions, and they must have been very hard for you to put to the page, let alone to hit publish.
Yes, that was particularly difficult for very obvious reasons. And I just wanted to get down on paper how I felt at the time, because those feelings I had at the time were what stopped me getting help and going to the authorities about it. And I would say I enjoy is the wrong word, but I've got I think quite good in my writing at, you know, dissecting my feelings and working out why I'm thinking something. And I thought that potentially by digging into those feelings I had at the time, that it might possibly resonate with other people who have been through similar experiences. I am shocked. I mean, absolutely dumbfounded by the number of people who've been victims of sexual assault. And a number of friends of mine have since opened up to me about their own similar experiences, and it's heartbreaking.
Well, you know what it is, because silence is enabling, isn't it? So by talking about it, by percolating this conversation, that in itself is massively helpful, because you realise, like, you know, just the fact that you've shared this means that other people have come to you and gone, yeah, me too. And you realise you're not alone.
Yes.
Every step of sharing has a benefit to you and others. It must be very freeing in some ways, as difficult as it was, to have it out there.
It has been for sure. It has been for sure. It was the initial writing of it, publishing of it was very difficult. To be honest, talking about it still is difficult. How could it not be? But I'm glad to talk about it, because there will be people listening to this who will hopefully, you know, think about speaking to someone. And once again, you know, it's so scary, the concept of speaking to someone about it, but ultimately, you don't get better by keeping things inside, even though your brain is tricking you that's the path you should follow. It's never the right path, is to keep it to yourself. But I'm glad it's out there.
I would implore anybody that feels that this has touched a nerve in any way, or it resonates with them, go and read the book. Read it in its full context, because even talking at length on a podcast, we can't do it the justice that context can, so that people can fully understand what your experience has been. And I don't want to try and reduce it into something that's a soundbite, but I applaud your bravery. And as difficult as it is to share these things, think how difficult it is with the consequences of not sharing. And that's, you know, it takes us back to what we were talking about, how many people take their own lives as a result of an abuse like this. And by opening up and sharing and talking about it and realising you're not alone, in some ways, you're still carrying out pretty much life-saving work, Doctor.
There's a huge gulf between the value of the arts and the value of the doctor on Labour Board. My overriding feeling, whether it comes from guilt or whatever, since leaving medicine, is to try and sort of use my powers for good rather than evil. And whether that's using my sort of my loud voice to amplify the voices of junior doctors, or by writing about stuff to a hopefully big audience that can give the odd person a bit of hope or an idea about a direction to turn in. That is the single most meaningful thing for me in my new job, and it means more the idea that the odd person might gain something personally from it. That means more than any of the facts and figures about you've sold this many copies in Poland, or this TV company is doing that thing with that book. That's what it's about.
Okay, time for our third and final question. Elaborate lies. Let's go there, because you've documented many over the course of your books. But one of the very best I loved was Luke, your imaginary agent, Luke. I've got the name right, haven't I?
You have, yes, absolutely. Although with an imaginary agent, it doesn't really matter what their name is. So I'd hit a stumbling block in my career. I wanted to be a writer. I was sure I should be a writer. Unfortunately, the people who employed writers in television weren't so sure that I should be a writer, and I just wasn't getting the work. And one of the big things you have to do to be taken seriously, or certainly was back then, I don't know if it is now, is you have to have an agent who can, you know, fight your corner, put you forward for stuff. This somehow, you know, that I don't know.
Well, it speaks of quality, doesn't it? It just says that you've got a certain standing.
Yeah. You do, yeah. This agent believes that I'm good, so they're going to... Anyway, I wrote a lot of letters to emails to agents, and no one really wanted to have me, which was fair enough. I mean, at the time, my writing was absolutely terrible, and I'd basically done none of it. So I thought, you know, what I need is a fake agent, and all you need for a fake agent is an email address, and so I was my own agent.
People would email Luke,
yes,
but really they were emailing you, and then you also had the ingenuity of coming up with the name of some woman from accounts who would chase invoices for you.
I mean, I would say that at that time in my career. I was spending more time scripting these messages from imaginary agents and coming up with their lives and personalities and character arcs than I was actually doing any paid writing. But as with all lies, it came crashing down because someone in a production company wanted to speak to Luke. Which was a problem, because Luke had a voice very, very similar to mine. Had a very similar phone number to mine, and so there were all sorts of can't quite remember what the excuses were, but it was laryngitis. Then he's out the country, or his tongue's fallen off, whatever it was. But they did want to jump on the phone, and then. What I had to do then was beg James, my husband, who was then my boyfriend, to inhabit the character of Luke and do this phone call. I mean, he did all right. I don't think he really felt Luke's true motivations. I think he was his Scottish, you know, his Edinburgh accent could have been a bit broader. But anyway, but aside from that, I thought that was the end of that particular agent, because that's the problem with lying, isn't it?
But when do you think it's okay to stretch the truth? And where have some of your better lies taken you?
I don't think I'm a particularly good liar. I think that they generally just sort of embarrassingly unravel at some point. I mean, I thought I was a very good liar. I was lying about my eating disorder dozens of times a day to dozens of people, to everyone in my life. And lots of people knew, and lots of people, you know, I would make excuses for why I couldn't, you know, eat with my flatmate, so I grabbed a sandwich on the way home, or why I wouldn't come out to the pub, or or it was a Jewish festival that meant I was fasting, or whatever it was. I had a reason, and I thought I was being so clever, but people, you know, found out in a quite sort of dramatic way as it happened. You know, there was unequivocal evidence of what was going on with me, and I was a much worse liar than I thought, because people already knew. And I guess in life people don't generally call you out for lying because it's embarrassing, isn't it? I'd be too embarrassed to call someone out for lying, so I don't. So maybe they wander around thinking that they're any better at lying than my 3-year-old nephew who's pretending he doesn't have, you know, chocolate around his mouth.
Yeah. Oh, Adam, I've loved talking to you. And I know that all of this and more will be covered in the live shows up in Edinburgh. How does it feel to be going back to almost where it all began? I mean, this is almost 360, isn't it? You started performing there in 2016 in support of junior doctors striking. And here we are. You're back in Edinburgh. Junior doctors are striking.
I mean, I wish junior doctors didn't have to be striking. I would change that bit about it. I wish that the government would come to their senses, and hopefully by August they will have done. I'm sure they will have done. They must do, surely. But Edinburgh is the most wonderful, I mean, it's the most wonderful city, full stop. But in August, the festival is just a magical place. It's not without its faults. It has become extremely expensive to both perform at and visit, and hopefully something will change with the cost of accommodation. It's at risk of becoming exclusive, where only people like me, who know they can bring an audience, you know, feel confident coming up, and the people who want to bring up their first show to a room of 30 people are priced out of it. I think that needs to change. But the experience of the Edinburgh Festival is absolutely wonderful, and I know lots of places say there is something for everyone, but there is truly something for everyone. Whether it's you want something for your 4-year-old, your 14-year-old, or your 94-year-old, whether you want, you know, ballet, whether you want, you know, really tough, chewy theatre, the sort of stuff that I never watch, or art galleries, or for me it's the comedy at the Fringe Festival. There is so much going on, literal thousands of different shows, to the extent that if there aren't shows that you that appeal to you in the Edinburgh Fringe, then you just don't have a sense of humour, because there are, you have to like some, you have to. There's all sorts of comedy. There's thousands of shows.
It's a buffet.
It really is. It's a huge buffet. It's a Vegas buffet. It's one of these football pitch-sized buffets with every single possible cuisine. And as much as I'm looking forward to performing, which I am, I'm more than that. I'm looking forward to seeing shows, not just my friend shows, who I'll obviously feel obliged to see, but going through the brochure, going through the website, seeing, thinking, that looks good, picking up a flyer from someone, thinking, yeah, that sounds good, because that is how you see the very best comedy there is.
The show runs from the 2nd to the 28th at the Pleasance in Edinburgh. Tickets are on sale right now. You can get them wherever you get your tickets, or you can visit adamkay.co.uk. Adam also has a brand new podcast. It's called The List of Absolutely Everything That Might Kill You. It kind of does what it says on the tin. Check it out. And thank you so much for finding the time to step away from the preparation of the show, the podcast, and I hope another book. Is there another book in the making?
There is another book. There's always another book. The one I'm finishing at the moment is another kid's book, which has been something we're doing for the last few years. And then it's time to go back to grown-ups.
Adam, continued success in all that you do. Keep using your voice. It's really important. And it's been a pleasure getting to know you better, both here in the last hour, but also over the last few days, by kind of literally just burying myself in your writing. I've enjoyed it inordinately.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely chatting.
My huge thanks to Adam Kay for joining me. You can catch him live at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. He's at the Pleasance from the 2nd till the 28th of August. Tickets are on sale now. Just head over to his website. That's adamkay.co.uk. You can also catch his podcast. It's called The List of Absolutely Everything That Might Kill You and does exactly what it says on the tin. And if you're in the mood for more conversation, well, why not dive into the back catalogue where you'll find authors like E.L. James in there. There's Dr. Alex George talking very much about his experience of mental health within the NHS. Giovanna Fletcher's there, Richard and Judy, who run a book club. Al Murray's in there, sharing his own experiences of A, writing a book, and B, being encouraged by a doctor to pursue comedy. That doctor was Dr. Harry Hill. And don't forget, we've started dropping an extra mini episode every week now on a Tuesday. It's called Something from the Cellar, and it brings up some of the very best bits from some of our very best guests over the last 4 years. To make sure it lands in your feed, just make sure you're following or subscribing to the show. And I'll be back Friday with a brand new guest. Until then, thanks so much for loaning me your ears.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with The Second Tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search Second Tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.